ounces, and they were joined at the back of the head. Immediately after birth, the twins were taken to the children's hospital, and Teresa didn't see them until 3 days later. When she finally saw her babies, Joseph stood at her side, ready to catch her and carry her from the room if necessary. She stared at the joined infants in front of her. Words like monster fled from her, and Teresa saw only two tiny boys, her babies, and her heart melted. Tears streamed down her face. Her husband embraced her, and then they hugged their sons. "You are ours," she said to the boys, "and I already love you." Mother love never deserted Teresa Binder, although the days ahead were difficult, heartbreaking at times. Her protective care grew stronger. The parents had to learn how to hold the babies to be sure they were both well supported. Because their heads turned away from each other, Teresa had to sit them against a cushion and hold a bottle of milk in each hand to feed them. Although the twins shared no vital organs, they did share a section of the skull and skin tissue, as well as a major vein responsible for draining blood from the brain and returning it to the heart. 5 weeks after their birth, the Binders took their sons home. "Not once did we ever not love them," Joseph said. "They were our sons." Because of their being joined at the heads, the boys couldn't learn to move like other infants, and yet, from the beginning, they acted like two individuals. One often slept, as the other cried. The Binders lived with the hope that their chubby, blonde sons would one day be separated. As they considered the future of Patrick and Benjamin, they learned that if the boys remained attached, they would never sit, crawl, turn over, or walk. The two beautiful children would remain bedridden and relegated to lying on their backs for as long as they lived. Not much of a prospect for them. "I have lived with a dream that has kept me going," Teresa told me when we first met. "A dream that somehow we would find doctors able to perform a miracle." Night after night, as Teresa went to bed, her last thoughts centered on cuddling and holding each of her sons separately, playing with them one at a time, and putting them in different cradles. Many of those nights she lay in bed, her eyes wet with tears, wondering if there would ever be a miracle for her sons. No one had successfully separated Siamese twins joined at the back of the cranium, with both surviving. "But I didn't give up hope. I couldn't. These were my sons, and they were the most important thing in my life," she said. "I knew I would fight for their chance as long as I lived." The baby's physicians in West Germany contacted us at Johns Hopkins, asking if the pediatric surgical team could devise a plan to separate the Binder twins and give them their chance to live normal, separated lives. That's when I came into this story. After studying the available information, I tentatively agreed to do the surgery, knowing it would be the riskiest and most demanding thing I had ever done. But I also knew that it would give the boys a chance, their only chance, to live normally. My making that decision was only one phase because this would not be a one-doctor procedure. Dr. Mark Rogers, director of pediatric intensive care at Hopkins, coordinated the massive undertaking. We assembled 7 pediatric anesthesiologists, 5 neurosurgeons, 2 cardiac surgeons, 5 plastic surgeons, and, just as important, dozens of nurses and technicians. 70 of us in all. We would also undergo 5 months of intensive study and training preparation for this unique surgery. Craig Dufresne, Mark Rogers, David Nichols, and I planned to fly to West Germany in May 1987. During our 4 days there, Dufresne would insert inflatable silicone balloons under the scalps of the babies. This device would gradually stretch the skin so that enough tissue would be available to close the huge surgical wounds following the separation. When it came to the surgery, I would do the actual separating, and then Donlin Long would work on one boy while I took the other. To make our chances for success better, I'd have the best qualified medical team at my side, all from Johns Hopkins, and they included Bruce Reitz, director of cardiac surgery, Craig Dufresne, assistant professor of plastic surgery, David Nichols, pediatric anesthesiologist, and Donlin Long, chairman of neurosurgery, with Mark Rogers as coordinator and spokesman. Since I had seen only x-rays of the children, I needed personally to assess their neurological ability, so I would be part of the team going to Germany to determine if the surgery was still feasible. Then, 2 weeks before the 4 of us were scheduled to go, thieves broke into our house. Aside from things like electronic equipment, they also stole our safe, which they couldn't get open. The small safe, not much larger than a shoebox, contained all our important documents and papers, including our passports. While realizing it would be difficult to replace the passport in 2 weeks, I didn't know it would be impossible. When I called the State Department, the kind but efficient voice said, "I'm sorry, Dr. Carson, but nothing can be done in such a short period." I then asked the police investigator, "What are the chances of getting back my papers, especially the passport?" "No chance," he snorted. "You don't ever get those kinds of things back. They trash them." After hanging up, I prayed. "Lord, somehow you've got to get me a passport if you want me to be involved in this surgery." I tried not to think about the passport. Because of my caseload, I became so absorbed in other things, I put the matter out of my mind. 2 days later, the same policeman phoned my office. "You won't believe this, but we have your papers. And your passport." "Oh, I believe it," I said. In an amazed tone, he told me that a detective had been rummaging through garbage. In a big plastic bag, he found a paper with my name on it and started digging further. Then he found all the other things, every single important stolen document. From that discovery, they were able to bust a large crime ring in the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area and to recover all of our other equipment, along with items stolen from other families. Our team spent the next 5 months in planning and working through every contingency we could envision. Part of the preparation required the rewiring of an entire section of a large operating room with emergency power ready in case of power failure. The OR had two of everything: anesthesia monitors, heart-lung machines, and tables that would lie side by side, but that we could move apart once I made the incision that separated the boys. At the end of the 5 month period, everything was so organized that at times it felt as if we were planning a military operation. We even worked out where each team member would stand on the operating room floor. A 10-page play-by-play book detailed each step of the operation. We endlessly discussed the 5 3-hour dress rehearsals we'd had, using life-sized dolls attached at the head by Velcro. From the time we started discussing it, we all tried to keep in mind that we wouldn't proceed with surgery unless we believed we had a good chance of separating the boys without damaging the neurological function of either baby. Neither Donlin Long nor I could be certain that parts of the critical brain tissue, such as the vision center, were wholly separate. Fortunately, as we had expected, the boys shared only a main drainage system, called the superior sagittal sinus, a critically important vein. Surgery on the 7-month-old twins began on Labor Day weekend, Saturday, September 5, 1987, at 7:15 a.m. We chose that day because the hospital itself would be less busy with plenty of staff available. We don't schedule elective surgery on weekends. Mark Rogers had advised the parents to stay in their hotel room during the operation so they could get some rest. As I would have expected, they rested very little, and one of them was sitting next to the phone at all times. During the next 22 hours, one of the doctors called the Binders to update them at each stage of the ordeal. Heart surgeons Wrights and Cameron, after anesthetizing the twins, inserted hair-thin catheters in major veins and arteries to monitor the boys during the operation. With the children's heads positioned to prevent them from sagging and causing undue pressure on the skulls after separation, we cut into the scalp and removed the bony tissue that held the 2 skulls, carefully preserving it so that we could use it later to reconstruct their skulls. Next, we opened the dura, the covering of the brain. This was quite complex because of a number of convolutions or tortuous areas in the dura and in the dural planes between their brains, as well as a large abnormal artery running between the 2 brains which had to be sectioned. We had to complete all the sectioning of adhesions between the 2 brains before we made any attempt to separate the large venous sinuses. We isolated the top portion of the sinus and the bottom portion just below the torcula, the place where all the sinuses come together. Normally, this ranges in size from that of a quarter to a half dollar. Unfortunately, it was much larger. When we cut below the area where the torcula should have ended, we encountered fierce bleeding. We controlled the bleeding by sewing muscle patches into the area, but it was frightening bleeding. We proceeded further down, and I recall saying aloud, "The torcula can't extend much further." Yet each time we met with the same scenario, eventually We got all the way to the base of the skull where the spinal cord and the brainstem meet, and we were still having the same problem. We concluded that the torcula, instead of being the size of a half dollar, covered the entirety of the backs of both of their heads and was a gigantic, highly pressurized venous lake. This situation forced us to go into hypothermic arrest prematurely. In the planning sessions, we had carefully timed it to take from 3 to 5 minutes to separate the vascular structures and the remaining time simultaneously reconstructing them in both infants. We had each child hooked up to a heart-lung bypass machine and pumped their blood through it to cool their temperatures from 95 degrees Fahrenheit to 68 degrees. Slowly, we removed blood from the boys' bodies. This deep degree of hypothermia brings metabolic functions to a near halt and allowed us to stop the heart and blood flow for approximately an hour without causing brain damage. We had to stop the blood flow long enough to construct separate veins. During this time, the Binder twins remained in a state similar to suspended animation. We had figured that after an hour, the tissue's demand for nourishment supplied by the blood would cause irreparable tissue damage. This meant that once we had lowered the boys' body temperatures, we had to work quickly. Interestingly, this technique can only be used in infants under 18 months when the brain is still developing and is flexible enough to recover from such a shock. Just before 11:30 p.m., 20 minutes after we started lowering their body temperatures, came the critical moment. With the skulls already open, I prepared to sever the thin blue main vein in the back of the twins' heads that carried blood out of the brain. It was the last link remaining between the little boys. That completed, we pulled the hinged table apart, and Long had one boy and I had the other. For the first time in their young lives, Patrick and Benjamin were living apart from each other. Although free, the twins immediately faced a potentially deadly obstacle. Before we could restore the blood flow, working as two units, both Long and I would have to fashion a new sagittal vein from the pieces of pericardium, the covering of the heart, removed earlier. Someone started the big timer on the wall. We had 1 hour to complete our work and to restart the blood flow. We were racing against time, but I said to the nursing staff, "Please don't tell me what time it is or how much time we have left." We didn't want to know. We didn't need the extra pressure of someone saying, "You've only got 17 minutes left." We were working as fast as we could. I had instructed them, "When the hour is up, just turn the pumps back on. If they bleed to death, then they'll have to bleed to death, but we'll know we did the best we could." Not that I felt so heartless, but I didn't want to take the chance of brain damage. Fortunately, both Long and I were used to working under pressure, and we stayed at it, not letting our attention waver. It was an eerie experience, starting the surgery, because their bodies were so cold it was like working on a cadaver. In one sense, the twins were dead. Momentarily, I wondered if they would ever live again. In the planning sessions, I had anticipated that it would take about 3 to 5 minutes to cut through the sinuses. Then we would spend the remaining 50 to 55 minutes reconstructing the sinuses before we could turn the blood back on. "Oh, no," I mumbled under my breath. I'd hit a snag. I would need more time than I had planned to reconstruct the huge torcula on my twin. The torcula is the dreaded area for neurosurgeons because the blood rushes through that area under such pressure that a hole in the torcula the size of a pencil would cause a baby to bleed to death in less than a minute. After hypothermic arrest, it took 20 minutes to separate all of the vascular tissue, which meant we had used at least 3 times as much time as we had planned. We hadn't been able to predetermine this situation because the pressure in this vascular lake was so high that it washed out the dye during the angiogram. By using 20 minutes to separate the vessels, this gave us only 40 minutes to complete our work. Fortunately, the cardiovascular surgeons had been looking over our shoulders and observing the configuration of the sinuses as I was cutting through them. From pericardium, they cut pieces to exactly the right diameter and shape. Although they were estimating, these two men were so skillful that when they handed the pericardium to Long and me, all of the pieces fitted perfectly. We were able to sew them into place along the affected areas. At one point, perhaps 45 minutes into the hour, I knew we were moving close to the deadline. Without looking around, I sensed the tension level around me increasing, almost as if individuals were whispering to each other, "Are we going to finish in time?" Long completed his baby first. I completed mine within seconds before the blood started to flow again. We were right on target. A silence momentarily filled the operating room, and I was conscious only of the rhythmic humming of the heart-lung machine. "It's done," somebody said behind me. I nodded, exhaling deeply, suddenly aware that I'd been holding my breath during those last critical moments. The strain was telling on all of us, but we had refused to give in to it. Once we restarted the infant's hearts, we hit our second big obstacle, profuse bleeding from all the tiny blood vessels in the brain that had been severed during surgery. Everything that could bleed did bleed. We spent the next 3 hours using everything known to the human mind to get the bleeding controlled. At one point, we were certain we wouldn't make it. Pint after pint of blood flowed through their bodies, soon exhausting the supply on hand. We had expected the bleeding because we had to thin their blood with an anticoagulant in order to use the heart-lung machine. When we restarted their hearts, the blood was effectively anticoagulated, and we faced intense bleeding in the area of the wound. Their traumatized brains began to swell dramatically, which actually helped to seal off some of the bleeding vessels, but we didn't want it to cut off the blood supply. The most harrowing moment came when we learned that the supply of blood might run out. Rogers called the hospital blood bank. "I'm sorry, but we don't have much blood on hand," said the voice on the other end of the line. "We've checked, and there's no more anywhere in the city of Baltimore." "I'll give you mine if you need it," someone said as soon as Mark Rogers reported. Immediately, 6 or 8 people in the operating room volunteered on the spot to donate their blood, a noble gesture, but one that wasn't practical. Finally, the Hopkins Blood Bank called the American Red Cross, and they came through with 10 units, exactly what we needed. By the time the operation was over, the twins had used 60 units of blood, several dozen times more than their normal blood volume. The extensive head wounds measured approximately 16 inches in circumference. While this was going on, someone from the team was staying in touch with the parents, who had left their hotel and were now in the waiting room. We also had staff on hand making sure those of us on the team had food to eat during our infrequent breaks. We had planned to fit the twins immediately with Dufresne's creation of a titanium mesh covering mixed with a paste of crushed bone from the baby's shared portion of the skull. Once in place, the baby's skull bones would grow into and around the mesh, and it wouldn't need removal. First, however, we had to be able to get their scalps closed before their swelling brains came completely out of their skulls. We put the boys into a barbiturate coma to slow down the metabolic rate to the brain. Then Long and I moved back, and Dufresne's and his plastic surgery team went into action, working furiously, trying to get the scalp back together. Finally, they got things pretty much together on one boy, with a few gaps on the other. Dufresne would have to wait for a later date to install the titanium plates. We also ran into the problem that we didn't have enough scalp to cover both infants' heads. We temporarily closed Benjamin's with surgical mesh. Dufresne would plan a second operation to create a cosmetically acceptable skull if the infants continued to recover. If the infants continued to recover. Chapter 20. The rest of their story. If they recover. In every phase of the surgery, this was the underlying question. If. "Oh God," I prayed silently again and again, "let them live. Let them make it." Even if they survived the surgery, weeks would lapse before we could fully assess their condition. The waiting would be a constant strain because we would be constantly looking for the first signs of normalcy, all the while fearing that we might detect signs of brain damage. To give their severely traumatized brains a chance to recover without any lasting ill effect, we used the drug phenobarbital to put the babies into an artificial coma. Phenobarbital drastically reduced their brain's metabolic activity. We hooked them up to life support systems that controlled their blood flow and respiration. The brain swell was severe, but not worse than we had expected. We indirectly monitored the swelling by measuring changes in heart rate and blood pressure, and by periodic CT scans, which give a three-dimensional X-ray picture of the brain. The surgery ended at 5:15 a.m. on Sunday morning. It had taken 22 hours, and the battle wasn't over yet. When our team emerged from surgery to the sound of the applause of other hospital staff members, Rogers went directly to Teresa Bender, and with a smile on his face, asked, "Which child would you like to see first?" She opened her mouth to respond, and tears filled her eyes. Once we set in motion the plan to separate the Bender twins, the public relations office at Johns Hopkins informed the media of what we were doing. This was a historic operation. Although we hadn't known it, the waiting room and corridors were alive with reporters. Naturally, none of them got into the operating room. Heavy security in the hospital would have stopped them even if they had tried to get inside. Several of the local radio stations gave updates on the surgery every hour. Naturally, with this kind of coverage, untold thousands of the general public suddenly became involved in this surgical phenomenon. Later, I learned that many of the people who followed the updates had stopped during the day and prayed for our success. Once out of the operating room, exhaustion took over, and we wanted to collapse. In the minutes after surgery, I couldn't think of answering anybody's questions or talking about what we had done. Rogers delayed a press conference until later that afternoon, giving us a chance to rest and clean up a little. At 4, when I walked into the conference room, the magnitude of this surgery hit me. The room was wall-to-wall reporters with cameras and microphones. It may seem strange, but when one is doing a job, no matter what the job is, it's hard to comprehend the importance of it. That afternoon, only a few hours out of surgery, my thoughts centered on Patrick and Benjamin Binder. The media attention the historic surgery generated was one of the last things on my mind. In fact, I doubt that any of us were prepared for the response of reporters and the myriad questions they asked. We must have looked strange standing in front of the media people with our wrinkled clothes and fatigue-filled faces. We were tired, but elated. The first step had been a giant one, and we'd made it. But it was only the first step on a long road. "The success in this operation is not just in separating the twins," Mark Rogers said at the beginning of the news conference. "Success is producing two normal children." As Rogers answered questions, I kept thinking how grateful I felt to have been a part of this magnificent team. For 5 months, we had been one unit, all specialists, and all tackling the same problem together. The staff at the pediatric ICU and the consultants in the children's center reacted spectacularly. They rallied behind us and spent countless hours without charge, working to make this operation successful. I listened as Rogers explained the steps of the surgery and added, "It shook me that we were able to perform as a team at this level of complexity. We are capable of doing even better things than we believe we are if we challenge each other to do it." Although some of the others responded to questions, as the chief spokesman, Mark Rogers and I answered most of them. When reporters asked me about the boys' chances for survival, I told them, "The twins have a 50-50 chance. We had thought the whole procedure out well. Logically, it ought to work, but I also know that when you do what hasn't been done before, unexpected things are bound to happen." One reporter raised the question about their vision. "Will they be able to see, both of them?" "At this point, we simply don't know." "Why not?" "Number one," I said, "the twins are too young to tell us themselves." I did get a laugh from some of them. "Number two," I continued, "their neurological condition was impaired, and that would delay our ability to assess their visual capabilities. The boys were not yet capable of looking at things or following objects with their eyes." The next day, all over the world, headlines blared, "Twins blind from surgery." We never said that or implied any such statement. We said we couldn't tell. "But will they survive?" asked a reporter. "Can they live normal lives?" asked another. "It's all in God's hands now," I said. Besides believing that statement, I didn't know what else to say. As I walked out of the crowded room, I realized I had said everything that needed to be said. As pessimistic as I was about the eventual outcome of the surgery, I still felt a glow of pride in being able to work side by side with the best men and women in the medical field. And the end of the surgery wasn't the end of our teamwork. The postoperative care was as spectacular as the surgery. Everything in the weeks following the surgery confirmed again our togetherness. It seemed as if everyone from ward clerks to orderlies to nurses had become personally involved in this historic event. We were a team. A wonderful, marvelous team. Patrick and Benjamin Binder remained in a coma for 10 days. This meant that for a week and a half, nobody knew anything. Would they remain comatose? Would they wake up to start living a normal life? Be handicapped? We all waited. And we wondered. Probably most of us worried a little and prayed a lot. We hadn't done anything unusual by putting them into comas. We had put individuals in barbiturate comas for periods that long before. For instance, children with severe head trauma need the comas to keep their intracranial pressures down. We constantly checked the twins' vital signs. We felt the skin flaps to see how tense they were. Initially, they were quite tense, and then they started to soften, a good sign that said the swelling was lessening. Occasionally, when the barbiturate concentration would decrease, and we would see a movement, we'd say, "Well, they can move." At this point, we needed every sign of hope. "It's all in God's hands," I'd say, and then remind myself, "That's where it's always been." For at least the next week, whenever I'd go off duty, I expected someone to call me and say, "Dr. Carson, one of the twins has had a cardiac arrest. We're resuscitating him now." I couldn't relax much at home either, because I just knew the phone would ring and I'd hear the terrible, dreaded message. It wasn't that I didn't trust God or our medical team. It's just that we were in uncharted waters and, as doctors, knew that the complications were endless. I always expected the bad news. Fortunately, it never came. In the middle of the second week, we decided to lighten up on the coma. "They're moving," I said a couple of hours later when I stopped by to check. "Look, he moved his left foot. See?" "They're moving," someone beside me said. "They're both going to make it." We were beside ourselves with joy, almost like new parents who must explore every inch of their new babies. Every movement, from a yawn to the wiggling of toes, became a cause of celebration throughout the hospital. And then came the moment that brought tears to many of us. That same day, as soon as the phenobarbital wore off, both boys opened their eyes and started looking around. "He can see. They can both see. He's looking at me. See? See what happens when I move my hand?" We would have sounded crazy to anyone who didn't know the 5-month history of preparation, work, worry, and concern, but we felt exhilarated. In the days that followed, I'd find myself silently asking, "Is this real? Is this happening?" I hadn't expected them to survive for 24 hours, and they were progressing nicely every day. "God, thank you. Thank you," I heard myself say again and again. "I know you have had your hand in this." We did have some post-operative emergencies, but nothing that didn't come under control quickly. The pediatric anesthesiologists run the ICU. The people who had invested a tremendous amount of their time in this operation were the same ones who had been taking care of them post-operatively, so they really stayed on top of the situation. Then questions arose about their neurological ability. What would they be able to do? Could they learn to crawl? Walk? To perform normal activities? Week by week, Patrick and Benjamin started doing more and more things and interacting more responsively. Patrick, in particular, got to the point where he was playing with toys, rolling from one side to the other and doing well with his feet. One day, however, about 3 weeks before he went back to Germany, Patrick unfortunately sucked his food into his lungs. A nurse discovered him in bed in respiratory arrest. Her quick thinking enabled an emergency team to resuscitate him, but no one knew how long he had been without breathing. He was already blue. He wasn't the same after that. Sadly, without saying it, we knew this meant some kind of brain damage, but we had no idea how extensive. The brain can't tolerate more than a few seconds without oxygen. At the time the twins left Johns Hopkins, Patrick, despite his respiratory arrest, was making strides. Benjamin continued to do quite well, even though his responses were slower at first. He was soon doing the things Patrick was doing before he had had his arrest, such as rolling from side to back. Unfortunately, because of the parents' contractual agreement with Bunt magazine, I can write nothing about the progress of the twins after they left Johns Hopkins. On February 2, 1989, I do know that two separated and much-loved twin boys celebrated their second birthdays. Chapter 21. Family Affairs. Candy's voice, near, urgent, called me from a deep sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning. "Ben! Ben, wake up!" I burrowed deeper into my pillow. It had been a tiring day. I'd spent the day, May 26, 1985, at our church, involved in an event for runners called Healthy Choices. We had invited people to run 1 kilometer, 5, or 10. Other doctors and I gave quick physical examinations and personal health profiles, while experts provided tips on healthier living and better running. Candy, waiting out her final month of pregnancy, had walked in the 1K. Now she nudged me and said, "I'm having contractions." I forced my eyes to crack open. How far apart? 2 minutes. It only took a moment for that message to leap into my brain. "Get dressed," I commanded as I leaped from the bed. We had a half-hour drive ahead of us to get her to Hopkins. Our first son, born in Australia, had come after 8 hours of labor. We figured this one would arrive a little faster. "The pain started just a few minutes ago," she said, swinging her feet to the floor and pulling herself out of bed. Halfway across the room, Candy paused. "Ben, they're coming more frequently." Her voice was so matter-of-fact she could have been commenting on the weather. I don't recall what I answered. I was fairly calm, still methodically getting dressed. "I think the baby's coming," Candy said. "Now." "You're sure?" I jumped up, grabbing her shoulders and helping her back into bed. I could see that the head was starting to crown. She lay quietly and pushed. I felt perfectly fine and not particularly excited. Candy behaved as if she delivered a baby every other month. I recall being thankful for my experience in delivering babies, aware that they had all been brought into this world under better circumstances. Within minutes, I had caught the baby. "A boy," I said. "Another boy." Candy tried to smile, and the contractions continued. I waited for the placenta. My mother was staying with us, and I yelled to her, "Mother, bring towels. Call 911. Afterward, I wondered if my voice sounded like it did with a 4-plus emergency. Once I had the placenta, I said, "I need something to clip the umbilical cord. Where can I find something?" My main concern then was to clamp the umbilical cord, and I had no idea what to use. Without answering me, Candy pulled herself out of bed and walked fairly steadily into the bathroom, returning immediately with a large bobby pin. I put it on the cord. About that time, I heard the paramedics arriving. They took Candy and our newborn, whom we named Benjamin Carson Jr., to the local hospital. Later, my friends asked, "Did you charge a delivery fee?" "Too busy," I told myself for the 100th time. "Something's got to change." It was an echo, a bouncing off the wall echo that I'd repeated time and time before. This time, I knew I had to make changes. Like others at Hopkins, I faced a serious dilemma with an active neurosurgical career. Working in a teaching hospital demanded a greater commitment to time and patience than I would have faced if I had my own practice. How do I find adequate time to spend with my family? I asked myself. Unfortunately, neurosurgery is one of those unpredictable fields. We never know when problems are going to arise, and many of them are extremely complex, requiring a tremendous investment of time. Even if I devoted myself exclusively to a clinical practice, I would still have bad hours. When I throw on top of that the necessity of continuing laboratory research, writing papers, preparing lectures, remaining involved in academic projects, and more recently, presenting motivational talks to young people, there weren't enough hours in any day or week. It meant that, if I wasn't careful, every area of my life would suffer. For days, I thought about my schedule, my commitments, my values, and what I could eliminate. I liked everything I was doing, but I saw the impossibility of trying to do it all. First, I concluded that my top priority was my family. The most important thing I could do was to be a good husband and father. I would reserve my weekends for my family. Second, I wouldn't allow my clinical activities to suffer. I decided to go all out to be the best clinical neurosurgeon I could be and contribute as much as I could to the well-being of my patients. Third, I wanted to serve as a good role model to young people. Although I believe it was the correct decision, the process wasn't easy. It meant budgeting my time, giving up things I enjoyed doing, even things that would further my career. For instance, I'd like to do more publishing in the medical field, sharing what I've learned and pushing toward more intense research. Public speaking appeals to me, and more opportunities were coming my way to speak at national meetings. Naturally, these outlets also would enable me to advance rapidly through academic ranks. Fortunately, many of those things seem to be happening anyway, but not as fast as they would if I were able to devote more time to them. Important also was the need to spend time in my own church. Right now I'm an elder at Spencerville Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm also Health and Temperance Director, which means I present special programs and coordinate the other medical workers in our church. For instance, we sponsor activities such as marathons, and I help in coordinating such events and organizing the medical screening. Our denomination stresses health, and I promote the Health Conscious magazine's Vibrant Life and Health among our congregation. I also teach an adult Sabbath school class in which we discuss the issues of Christianity and their relevancy to our daily lives. The first step toward freeing my time took place in 1985. We had gotten so busy at the hospital that we had to bring in another pediatric neurosurgeon. This additional staff member took some pressure off me. Hiring another man was quite a step for Hopkins because, since the beginning of the institution in the last century, pediatric neurosurgery had been a one-person department. Even today, few institutions have two professionals on staff. At Hopkins, we're talking about three, and possibly a fellowship in pediatric neurosurgery because we have such a high volume of cases and we see no signs of its abating. Additional personnel didn't really solve my dilemma, however. Early in 1988, I admitted to myself that no matter how hard I worked or how efficiently, I would never finish the work, not even if I stayed in the hospital until midnight. Then I made my decision, one that, with God's help, I could stick to. I would leave for home every evening at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at the latest. That way, I could at least see my children before they went to bed. "I can't finish everything," I said to Candy, who has been totally supportive. "It's impossible. There's always just a little more to be done, so I may as well leave work unfinished at 7 p.m. instead of 11. I've held to that schedule. I finish my work at the hospital by 7:30, and I'm back at the office 12 hours later. It's still a long day, but working 11 or 12 hours is reasonable for a doctor. Staying at it 14 to 17 hours isn't. As more speaking opportunities come, they involve traveling. When I have to go a great distance, I take the family with me. When the children get into school, that will have to change. For now, whenever I'm invited to speak, I ask if transportation and accommodations can be provided for my family, too. We're anticipating that my mother will be living with us soon, and she can take care of the children sometimes while Candy and I travel. As busy as I am, as many people as require my time, I think it will be good for Candy and me to be alone together. Without her support, my life would not be the success it is today. Before we married, I told Candy that she wouldn't see much of me. "I love you, but I'm going to be a doctor, and that means I'm going to be very busy. If I'm going to be a doctor, I'll be a driven person, and it's going to take a lot of time. If that's something you can live with, then we can get married. But if you can't, we're making a mistake." "I can deal with that," she said. Did I sound selfish? Did my idealism cloud my commitment to the woman who would be my wife? Perhaps the answer is yes on both questions, but I was also being realistic. Candy has coped extremely well with my long hours. Maybe it's because she is confident and secure in herself that she can support me so well. Because of her support, I handle the demands more easily. While I was an intern and a junior resident, I was seldom around because I worked 100 to 120 hours a week. Obviously, Candy seldom saw me. I'd call her, and if she had a few minutes, she'd come over and bring my meal. I'd eat, and we'd spend a few minutes together before she went home. During that period, Candy decided to return to school. She said, "Ben, I'm at home every night by myself, so I may as well go and do something." Candy has a lot of creative energy, and she put it to use. At one church, she started a choir, and an instrumental ensemble in another. During our year in Australia, she started a choir and instrumental ensemble. We now have three children. Royce was born December 21st, 1986, making us a family of five. I grew up without a father, and I don't want my sons to grow up without one. It's vitally important that they know me, rather than just looking at my pictures in a scrapbook or magazine or seeing me on television. My wife, my sons, they are the most important part of my life. Chapter 22. Think big. Candy and I share a dream unfulfilled as yet. Our dream is to see a national scholarship fund set up for young people who have academic talent, but no money. This scholarship would help them to gain any type of education they want in any institution they want to attend. Most philanthropic funds are too politically oriented and depend too much on knowing the right people or getting important people behind you. We dream of a scholarship program that recognizes pure talent in any field. We dream of seeking out those gifted young people who deserve a chance for success, but would never get near it because of lack of funds. I would very much like to be in a position where I could do something to help make that dream a reality. I put think big into practice in my own life. As my life moves forward, I want to see thousands of deserving people of every race moving into leadership because of their talents and commitments. People with dreams and commitments can make it possible. What's the key to your success? The teenage boy with the afro asked. It wasn't a new question. I'd heard it so many times that I finally worked out an acrostic answer. Think big, I told him. I'd like to break this down and explain the meaning of each letter. Think big. T equals talent. Learn to recognize and accept your God-given talents, and we all have them. Develop those talents and use them in the career you choose. Remembering T for talent puts you far ahead of the game if you take advantage of what God gives you. T also equals time. Learn the importance of time. When you are always on time, people can depend on you. You prove your trustworthiness. Learn not to waste time because time is money and time is effort. Time usage is also a talent. God gives some people the ability to manage time. The rest of us have to learn how. And we can. H equals hope. Don't go around with a long face expecting something bad to happen. Anticipate good things. Watch for them. H also equals honesty. When you do anything dishonest, you must do something else dishonest to cover up, and your life becomes hopelessly complex. The same with telling lies. If you're honest, you don't have to remember what you said the last time. Speaking the truth each time makes life amazingly simple. I equals insight. Listen and learn from people who have already been where you want to go. Benefit from their mistakes instead of repeating them. Read good books like the Bible because they open up new worlds of understanding. N equals nice. Be nice to people. All people. If you're nice to people, they'll be nice to you. It takes much less energy to be nice than it does to be mean. Being kind, friendly, and helpful takes less energy and relieves much of the pressure. K equals knowledge. Knowledge is the key to independent living, the key to all your dreams, hopes, and aspirations. If you are knowledgeable, particularly more knowledgeable than anybody else in a field, you become invaluable and write your own ticket. B equals books. I emphasize that active learning from reading is better than passive learning such as listening to lectures or watching television. When you read, your mind must work by taking in letters and connecting them to form words. Words make themselves into thoughts and concepts. Developing good reading habits is something like being a champion weightlifter. The champion didn't go into the gym one day and start lifting 500 pounds. He toned his muscles, beginning with lighter weights, always building up, preparing for more. It's the same thing with intellectual feats. We develop our minds by reading, by thinking, by figuring out things for ourselves. I equals in-depth learning. Superficial learners cram for exams, but know nothing 2 weeks later. In-depth learners find that the acquired knowledge becomes a part of them. They understand more about themselves and their world. They keep building on prior understanding by piling on new information. G equals God. Never get too big for God. Never drop God out of your life. I usually conclude my talks by telling young people, if you can remember these things, if you can learn to think big, nothing on earth will keep you from being successful in whatever you choose to do. My concern for young people, especially disadvantaged young people, first hit me the summer I worked as a recruiter for Yale. When I saw the SAT scores of those kids and how few of them made anywhere near 1,200, it saddened me. It also bothered me because I knew from my own experiences growing up in Detroit that scores didn't always reflect how smart people are. I'd met a lot of bright youngsters who could grasp things quickly, and yet, for a variety of reasons, they scored poorly on their SAT exams. Something's wrong with the society, I've told Candy more than once, that has a system precluding these people from achieving. With the right help and the right incentive, many disadvantaged kids could achieve outstanding results. I made a commitment to myself that at every opportunity, I'd encourage young people. As I became more well-known and started getting more opportunities to speak, I decided that teaching kids how to set goals and achieve them would be a constant theme of mine. Nowadays, I get so many requests, I can't accept anywhere near all of them, yet I try to do as much as I can for young people without neglecting my family and my duties at Johns Hopkins. I have strong feelings on the subject of American youth, and here's one of them. I'm really bothered at the emphasis given by the media on sports in the schools. Far too many youngsters spend all their energies and time on the basketball courts wanting to be a Michael Jordan, or they throw their energies toward being a star on the baseball diamond or football field. They want to make $1 million a year, not realizing how few who try make those kinds of salaries. These kids end up throwing their lives away. When the media doesn't emphasize sports, it's music. I often hear of groups, and many of them good, who pour out their hearts in a highly competitive career, not realizing that only one group in 10,000 is going to make it big. Rather than putting all their time and energy into sports or music, these kids, these bright, talented young people, should be spending their time with books and self-improvement, ensuring that they'll have a career when they're adults. I fault the media for perpetuating these grandiose dreams. I spend quite a bit of time talking to the freshman groups and trying to help them realize that they have a responsibility to each one of the communities they have come from to become the best they can be. While going to schools and talking to these young people, I try to show them what they can do and that they can make a good living. I urge them to emulate successful adults in the various professions. To the successful professionals, I say, take young people to your house. Show them the car you drive. Let them see that you have a good life, too. Help them to understand what goes into getting that good life. Explain that there are many ways to a fulfilled life besides sports and music. A lot of young people are terribly naive. I've heard one after another say, I'm going to be a doctor, or a lawyer, or maybe president of the company. Yet they have no idea what kind of work goes into achieving such positions. I also talk to parents, teachers, and anybody else associated with the community, asking them to focus on the needs of these teens. These kids must learn how to achieve change in their lives. They need help. Otherwise, things will never get better. They'll just get worse. Here's an example of how this works. In May 1988, the Detroit News ran a feature story on me in their Sunday supplement. After reading the article, a man wrote to me. He was a social worker and had a 13-year-old son who also wanted to be a social worker. However, things had not been going well. The father had been evicted, then lost his job. He and his son were looking for their next meal, and his world had turned upside down. He was so depressed that he was ready to commit suicide. Then he picked up the Detroit News and read the article. He wrote, "Your story just turned my life around and gave me hope. Your example inspired me to go on and put my best efforts into life again. I now have a new job, and things are starting to turn around. That article changed my life." I've also gotten a number of letters from students in various schools who are not doing well, but through their reading about me, seeing me on television, or hearing me speak, were challenged to redouble their efforts. They're making an attempt to learn things, and that means they're going to be the best they can be. A single parent mother wrote, telling me she had two children, one of whom wanted to be a fireman, the other a doctor. She said they had all read my story and had been inspired. Learning about my life and how my mother helped me turn my life around actually inspired her to go back to school. By the time she wrote to me, she had been accepted into law school. Her children had turned their grades around and were doing very well. Letters like that make me feel very good. At Old Court Middle School in the Baltimore suburbs, they started the Ben Carson Club. To be a member, students have to agree that they will watch no more than 3 television programs each week, and they will read at least 2 books. When I visited that school, they did a unique thing. Club members had previously received biographical information about my life, and they held a contest. The winners were those students who correctly answered the most questions about me. On my visit, the 6 winners came to the stage and answered questions about me and my life. I listened, amazed at how much they knew about me, and humbled that my life had touched theirs. It still seems unreal to me when I go places and people are excited to see me. While I don't fully understand, I realize that particularly for black people in this country, I represent something that many of them have never seen in their lifetimes. Someone in a technical and scientific area who has risen to the top. I'm recognized for my academic and medical achievements instead of being a sports star or an entertainer. While this doesn't happen often, it does happen, reminding me that I'm not the one big exception. For instance, I have a friend named Fred Wilson who was an engineer in the Detroit area. He's black, and the Ford Motor Company selected him as one of their top 8 engineers worldwide. He's incredibly bright and has done outstanding work, yet few know about his achievements. When I make public appearances, I like to think I'm holding up my own life and all of the others who've shown that being a member of a minority race doesn't mean being a minority achiever. I tell a lot of the students that I talk to about Fred Wilson and other black high achievers who just don't get media attention or have a high profile. When you're in a field like mine, at a place like Johns Hopkins, and you're putting out your best, it's hard to hide. Whenever any of us here do anything outstanding, the media finds out and the word spreads. I know a lot of other people in other, less glamorous fields who have done significant things, but hardly anyone knows about them. One of my goals is to make sure that teenagers learn about these highly talented individuals so they can have a variety of role models. When young people have good role models, they can change and set their sights toward higher achievements. Another goal is to encourage teenagers to look at themselves and their God-given talents. We all have these abilities. Success in life revolves around recognizing and using our raw material. I'm a good neurosurgeon. That's not a boast, but a way of acknowledging the innate ability God has given to me. Beginning with determination and using my gifted hands, I went on for training and sharpening of my skills. To think big and to use our talents doesn't mean we won't have difficulties along the way. We will. We all do. How we view those problems determines how we end up. If we choose to see the obstacles in our path as barriers, we stop trying. We can't win, we moan. They won't let us win. However, if we choose to see the obstacles as hurdles, we can leap over them. Successful people don't have fewer problems. They have determined that nothing will stop them from going forward. Whatever direction we choose, if we can realize that every hurdle we jump strengthens and prepares us for the next one, we're already on the way to success. You have been listening to Gifted Hands, The Ben Carson Story, by Ben Carson, M.D., with Cecil Murphy. Read by Dion Graham. Produced and recorded by Brad Hill at Zondervan Studios, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Recording copyright 2011 by Zondervan. This production contains the text of the book, Gifted Hands, copyright 1990 by Review and Herald Publishing Association. A letter from Sonia Carson, copyright 2011, by Sonia Carson, all rights reserved. Unauthorized duplication is prohibited by law. This Zondervan production is also available in printed and ebook editions. For a complete listing of all Zondervan productions, visit zondervan.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.